Hello, I'm Keith Perron, and welcome to Jazz for the Asking from PCJ Radio International.
Relax with me. I want you to kick off your shoes and sip your tea. Then we can slowly chase away all those blues. And I will murmur soft and low, tremolo. We'll pour some wine, or maybe champagne, very cold, your hand in mine. And as the evening slowly starts to unfold, you can ease your troubles away for today. So just believe you can achieve illusion. Suspend your perception of care and woes. Life can be arduous, confusion. So we'll luxuriate in languorous repose. Let's feel at ease, delight in the atmosphere divine. The evening breeze compels two hearts to tenderly entwine. So come and live your fantasy, relax with me.
Relax with me, Lee Gibson, our special guest on this edition of Jazz for the Asking from PCJ Radio International. Lee's career began, well, many, many years ago in one of the most unlikely places. It was the Benny Hill Show. Of course, at that time, she wasn't a jazz singer. That came much later, which we will find out on today's program. Here's a little sampling of one of the first songs, or actually the first song that she sang on The Benny Hill Show, Mad About You, on Jazz for the Asking. Lee, before I get to the first question, I have a little funny story to tell you about actually how I first heard you sing. I was probably, I would guess, 10 or 11 years old. And my dad, being French, we were watching television one evening. And right. With his French accent, he said, "What a lovely lady that is." And it was actually you singing in a costume, or as my mother put it, more like the label from the costume, singing to Benny Hill the song Mad About You.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Now, I want to talk about that a little later on, but was that the first big appearance that you did, or had you been performing in the UK doing the jazz club circuit?
No, I hadn't. I was sort of starting. At the start of my career, I was sort of beginning in theatre, and I was actually the leading lady at London's Talk of the Town at the time. And Benny came in one evening with some friends, came in and watched the show, and then offered me some work on the TV shows. So that's how that came about.
But was this some
jazz thing? Was much later, really.
But was this this career path that you took, was this something that you'd always wanted to do, or was this something that you thought, oh, this might be fun, I'll try it?
Oh, no. It was something, I can't remember a time when I didn't sing. I'm 2.5 years old, I was singing, and I don't remember a time when I didn't want to actually perform. But my first love was as a dancer. I wanted to be a dancer, desperately. And then I grew very tall. And when I hit 5'8", that was the end of that. So a lot of things sort of fell into place, and people, I was getting jobs as a singer dancer, and of course, anytime anybody wanted anything sung, it was, well, she can sing, so let's get her, you know. And that's the way it started, really.
Because the early performances, for example, that you did on the Benny Hill Show, there's a duet that you did with another singer by the name of John Kiefer.
That's right. Well, John and I were both in the show at the Talk of the Town together. And we used to do duets in that particular show, and that's where Benny saw us.
Right, but in those days you said you weren't doing jazz. Because the song that you did was a rock and roll song by the Byrds.
That's right, yes. No, the funny thing about the jazz thing, it's odd. I was brought up with, my father was a mad sort of big band and jazz fan, and playing records all day long. I virtually learned the whole American Songbook before I was about 8, because he was just playing all that music, you know, from Nat King Cole to George Shearing, you name it. And the silly thing was that every time I sang anything, people used to say, "Oh, you sound so jazzy," and I'm going, "What does that mean? I have no idea what you're talking about," you know. And people used to say I sounded a bit like Anita O'Day, and I phrased in a jazz way. And it wasn't until a bit later on when I met my husband, who was a jazz musician and an arranger, and then I got introduced to jazz. He took me down to Ronnie Scott's, and I started to sort of see people and listen, and that's how I got into it, really.
It's the wrong time and the wrong place. Though your face is charming, it's the wrong face. It's not his face, but such a charming face. It's alright with me. It's the wrong song with the wrong style. Though your smile is charming, it's the wrong smile. It's not his smile, but such a charming smile. It's all right with me. You don't know how happy I am that with that I'm strangely attracted to you. Someone I'm trying so hard to forget. Don't you want to forget someone too? It's the wrong game with the wrong chips. Though your lips are tempting, they're the wrong lips. They're not his lips, but they're such tempting lips that if some night you're free, then it's all right. It's all right with me.
You tell an interesting story because many of the jazz singers maybe that have come along in the last 25, 30 years, if I just think of one off the top of my head, Dinah Krall, one time asked her, I said, what is the greatest education you had? She said, well, when I was a girl growing up, listening to albums that we had for Ella Fitzgerald and Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra.
There you go. That's exactly right.
So it's almost
exactly
like
right.
the best kind of education that you have, you probably couldn't get that in a music school.
Well, you know what? I mean, I do come across a lot of young singers because I do teach in the conservatoire now, and most of them have to actually learn all that stuff from scratch. They don't hear it. They don't hear it on the radio. They don't hear it played. You know, luckily they've got YouTube, so they can go and find out about it. But you know, they've never really been brought up on that music, and I was. I'll be eternally grateful for that.
Who are some of your favourites?
Oh, gosh. Well, it varies from day to day. It's, I'm a mad fan on Sarah Vaughan. I thought she was absolutely fantastic. And, of course, I did have the chance to work with her in Germany, which was a real great experience. Sinatra, my father was a complete mad Sinatra buff, and just listening to him, his phrasing is just so immaculate, it's ridiculous. I love sort of things like Bobby McFerrin, Al Jarreau. I mean, yeah, great. There's some really great jazzers out there. Unfortunately, we've just lost Mark Murphy this year, which is a great shame because he was wonderful.
So today, then, you know, you've been doing it for a while. Does it still happen that you hear a singer and go, I haven't heard this before?
Oh, yeah. One that I've come across not that recently, about 4 or 5 years ago, Tierney Sutton. She's an American jazz singer. Really great stuff she's doing. And, of course, I was lucky enough to do Cork Jazz Festival last year. And what's her name? It's gone out of my head. Well, I can think of it as Diana Crawford. It'll come back in a minute. Anyway, yeah, well, she was on the bill, so I was really lucky. Although it was sold out, I managed to sneak my way into the back of the stalls and stand and watch her. She was fabulous.
Britain has a very interesting jazz scene. There's a big jazz history when a lot of the music came over in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. But there seems to be a very British way of doing it. I mean, if we take, say, a big band like Ted Heath and his big band,
yeah.
It had a very different sound, let's say, from the American big bands. A very different sound.
Yeah, sure, I know. And I think that's a lot to do with culture. The amazing thing is when I noticed that most, I suppose, when I went to South Africa and I was doing a jazz festival in Grahamstown, and the South African musicians, there were a lot of European musicians over there, and that was a very familiar sound. And then when the South African musicians were playing, it was jazz, but it was with a completely different accent. And I think it's kind of like if you get a Frenchman speaking English and then you get a Japanese guy speaking English, you can tell that they're not English. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
There's a flavour. However good their English is. And America is different from Britain, and Britain and Scandinavia tend to be, we tend to have a very similar sort of approach, I think. But down in South Africa, the South African musicians were amazing. They were putting this sort of almost township beat on everything. You know, it was fantastic. It was so fascinating to listen to. But it was like listening to something that you know, but with a different accent.
How would you say, if I was to ask you, you know, how would you describe yourself? Do you sing more in the American style of jazz or more the British style of jazz?
Oh, gosh.
Because when I listen to the CDs that I have, I hear very much more an American influence.
Yes, I think so. And certainly, but again, that's probably going back to my roots and listening to all that American music, when I was growing up. Certainly when I go to America, until I talk, they don't think I'm American. They think I'm American. Until I speak, and sort of introduce things. But then again, you know, that's like, I remember going to Manly Jazz Festival in Australia. It was hilarious. I did my set and I came off and this chap came over and he said, oh, gee, he said, oh, well, that was really good. He said, where are you from? Melbourne? And I went, no, England. And he goes, I knew the accent was posh.
Because there's a number of English jazz singers that when they do sing, you can tell right away that they are British just by the pronunciation of words. But with the stuff that you've done that I've heard, and even some of the recordings from the television appearances that you made in the 1970s, I don't hear that so much.
No, you're right. And I think I do sing with an American accent. In fact, there's one critic over here who hates me because I sing with an American accent. I'm not sounding British enough, but there you go. You can't win them all, can you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's sort of like if you hear British comedian actor Hugh Laurie, who played an American on television for many years.
Absolutely.
When you listen to his blues albums, you cannot tell that he's English.
No, not at all. Not at all. No.
It's not the pale moon that excites me, thrills and delights me. Oh no, it's just the nearness of you. It isn't your sweet conversation causes this sensation. Oh no, it's just the nearness of you. And when in your arms, I feel you so close to me. All my wildest dreams have come true. I need no satellites to entrance me. If you will only grant me the right to hold you ever so tight, and to feel in the night the nearness of you.
So for looking for songs, from what I gather, that you're really a big fan of the old songbook. Songs like, you know, if I Were a Bell, I've Got the World on a String.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I love all those old songs. They're tremendous. They just lend themselves to improvisation. They lend themselves to swing. And my big thing, I think, of anything, I don't care what it happens, as long as it swings. And I love singing like that. I love singing that sort of swinging stuff, you know.
Yeah, because I noticed that, you know, there's a lot of artists when they release, of course, on one album, there's different tempos. But you like really up-tempo songs, don't you?
Oh, well, I I think on my albums, I'm pretty, and certainly when I perform, I've got a fair mixture. I probably only have one or two really up-tempo things in each half of the set, say, and then there'll be a couple of ballads and a couple of mid-tempos. You know, I like to vary it quite a lot, but I'm not scared of up-tempo, shall I say that?
Mm-hmm. And what about recording? You know, many jazz artists, they said one of the things that they dread the most, it could be a vocalist or a musician, is the recording process, because they said it's not like where you're performing live, where you break away from whatever the arrangement is and you can go off into a completely direction. But in a studio without an audience, and you're very sort of, there's a lot of constriction going on. What about yourself?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of constraints on, I do find that, and I think it's very, very difficult. I can see why some of the pop and rock artists spend 3 months making an album. to be honest with you, over here particularly, you're lucky if you get 3 days, to be honest, and then you start mixing down, because it's time and money constraints more than anything else. Consequently, it does kind of, sometimes a lot of stuff that actually gets put out is a first track. But the funny thing is that, you put something down in the studio and then you go and have a listen to it. And it's so hard to be objective, because the bass player's listening to the bass and the piano player's listening to the piano. Nobody's really listening to the overall sound except the producer. So you just have to trust that they go, yeah, that's a good one, or no, we'll go back and do another one, Very strange.
One of the last albums that Frank Sinatra recorded when he was on Capitol Records before he went off to start Reprise, the album was recorded in less than 5 hours.
Right.
Because he just wanted to get out of Capitol to go to his own label. Yeah. And somebody said recently, they said, when you listen to it, it sounds like you can tell it's in the studio, but it sounds like a live performance.
A live performance, exactly.
Which is very difficult to capture, not just for a jazz vocalist, but in any type of performance.
I agree, and I think that's why I try and do them on one take, because the first take is usually the one where there's just that frisson of fear. I know that sounds crazy, but that everybody's sharp. The musicians are sharp, you're sharp, unless something disastrous happens. It's usually the one that's actually got the best atmosphere. It's strange. And yet, sometimes you go on and you do, take 14, and then you come back and you listen to one again, and you go, no, one's the best one. What are we doing? It's crazy.
And what about performing with groups? I mean, do you prefer performing with smaller groups or big orchestras?
Oh, both. Obviously, the Night Songs album, that was with the 72-piece orchestra in Holland. That was absolutely stunning. And that, funnily enough, was the one I probably had the most time to actually get stuff done. I think we did those tracks. We were doing 5 tracks in the morning, and that was really quite good. and they had got till the afternoon to do it. So, but I, again, being one take, preferring one takes, I got those done quite quickly. But that was a really fantastic experience. But then I do a lot with the big bands. I love big bands. So I work with the Fat Chops big band over here and BBC big band, obviously. That's great fun. And I have all my own charts, and they're all originals. So they are not original songs, but they are original arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always nice to do. And then the rest of the time, I'm with my trio or quartet or quintet, depending on how much people can afford.
So ask me, how do I feel? Ask me now that we're cozy and clinging. Well, sir, all I can say, if I were a bell, I would be ringing. From the moment we kissed tonight, that's the way I've just got to behave. Boy, if I were a lamp, I'd light. And if I were a banner, I'd wave. Ask me, how do I feel, little me, with my quiet upbringing? Well, sir, all I can say, if I were a gate, I would be swinging. And if I were a watch, I'd stop bumping my spring. Or if I were a bell, I'd go ding dong, ding dong, ding, ding dong, ding. Go, oh, ask me how do I feel, ask me now that we're cozy and clinging. Well, so all I can say is if I were a bell, I would be ringing from the moment we kissed tonight. That's the way I gotta behave, boy. If I were a lamp, I'd light. And if I were a bell, I'd wave. Ask me how do I feel, leave me with my quiet upbringing. Well, so all I can say,
a bell, I go ding dong ding. If I were a watch, I'd try to find my
Well, let's go back a bit again to what we were talking about at the beginning. You said that, you know, you were Benny Hill discovered you in a club, and then you ended up being on the show. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was lovely. I mean, Ben was such a nice man. He really was. He was very hands-on as far as everything to do with his shows were concerned. They were his babies. He used to take 6 months or so to write them, and then we would spend the winter months producing. So it would be 3 weeks, basically, to produce each show. And the first week would be out on location doing some shooting for some of the sketches that he would do. Like, one year I remember we had the sketch was all about the Wild West. It was quite a long shooting process. That was a week. And then there would be 2 weeks it took. Then the second week we would be in rehearsal rooms Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, rehearsing sketches. And then we would start pre-recording. And then the whole show, anything live, most of the musical performances, for example, were done live in front of an audience. And that would be shown on the Friday night. And so there was always that mixture of rehearsal and live performance and film performance. So it was a really nice show to do.
So when you were singing on the show, if I'm not mistaken, I believe the musical director was Ronnie Aldrich.
That's right.
Would he write the arrangements for you, or did you bring your own in?
Yeah, no, he would write the arrangements. I mean, we had a rehearsal pianist called Ted Taylor, who was a musical associate on the show, and he would write down everything that we were doing as far as sort of the routine of the arrangement. And then it would be taken to an arranger who would arrange it, and then there would be, I think it was usually Thursday afternoons, we'd be in the studio. And if there were any pre-recording and backing vocals and things to do, that would be done in the studio with the orchestra. And then on top of the orchestra track, we would actually perform live in front of the audience on the Friday.
So when you were performing with the orchestra, the orchestra was recorded, but you were singing live.
Yes, that's right.
how many of those shows did you end up doing?
Oh, I can't remember. I think I probably did about 7 or 8 shows. I did 2 or 3 for 2 or 3 seasons, three, four years.
And what was it like working at Thames Television? Because it was, at the time, it was one of the more popular ITV networks.
Yeah, absolutely. Thames was lovely. Really, the beautiful studios right by the river, up on the Thames there, and it was lovely. The only thing that was silly was because where I actually lived in London, which is northwest, Thames, of course, was southeast. So it was about the furthest of all the TV studios for me to travel to, and it was the one I did most of the work at, which is typical, you know. And just round the corner, of course, at that time was Elstree, and they were putting out things like the Tom Jones Show and Engelbert Humperdinck, you know. And I never got to work at Elstree. I mean, it was crazy. That's where the Muppets were recorded, and they were just round the corner from me. But that's.
But you also had a chance to work at Television Centre with the two Ronnies and Morecambe and Wise.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Were they all, like, you started off with Benny Hill, and you did Morecambe and Wise and the two Ronnies. Was it all very different to work in those shows?
How do you mean different?
Well, did they follow kind of the same schedule, or was one more stressful than the other, or was it all pretty much the same?
No, I mean, the two Ronnies, for the most part, we used to do a day's rehearsal on the Thursday, and then we would go into the studio and pre-record all the tracks on the Friday. So that was the way it was done. It was pre-recorded in the BBC studios at Television Centre, and then they were played on the Sunday. But some of the sketches that the two Ronnies did, including Little Ronnie when he was sitting in his chair, was done in front of a live audience. And occasionally, if we were actually in Vision, we would be on the Sunday as well, and probably miming to what we'd already pre-recorded. That was the way it went.
But how do you feel now when somebody says to you, you know, I saw you in 1973, and you were wearing a label as a costume?
Well, the hilarious thing is, I mean, you know, I hadn't seen it for sort of so many yonks, and now it's on YouTube. So it sort of burst on YouTube about 2 years ago. And it's hilarious because all these musicians who've known me as a serious musician and jazz singer suddenly went, I've just seen you on YouTube, not wearing anything. It's been hilarious, absolutely hilarious.
Because there's a lot of singers, when something like that comes around, they get embarrassed by it. But you know, I don't think you're embarrassed by it, are you? Or do you, do you say, I mean, yeah, but look at me, look at me?
Yeah, well, goodness me. I mean, I'm not exactly showing anything, really. It's only when I turn my back that it looks as if I haven't got anything on. That's fine.
This will be my shining hour, calm and happy and bright. In my dreams, your face will flower in the darkness of the night. Like the lights of home before me, or an angel watching over me. This will be my shining hour, till I'm with you again. This will be my shining. In the darkness of the night, like a light of hope before me, or an angel watching on me. This will be my shining hour, yeah, when I'm with you in this dream.
You know, it's funny to think that, you know, when you were doing these shows, did you think, oh, you know, I'd like to do light entertainment? I mean, did you ever have the possibility of doing your own series?
Well, not really, because at that time, I guess, I mean, the people that were getting their own shows in light entertainment were basically the pop singers. So you've got sort of Cliff Richards and Cilla Black and those sorts of people having their own shows. And I wasn't ever into the pop industry. I never really, I mean, I had one small brush with it, with Arista Records, but the record sank without trace, as they do sometimes, and the option wasn't picked up. So that was the end of my sort of pop career, in inverted commas. But just, no, not really. It's a shame, I suppose, but there you go. My life took another direction, mostly because I got married and had my daughter, and I didn't want to be travelling. So, therefore, doing the TV stuff was really the easiest option, to be honest, but without actually pushing myself forward. And it wasn't really until my daughter sort of grew up a bit and I felt I could travel a bit more. But I then went back to working live and getting the music career going with the jazz, which was my first sort of, I decided by then that was my first love, so that's what I wanted to do, and the rest is history.
How much time do you spend touring?
Now?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh. Well, I put it this way, I can't have a dog, because I'm not at home enough. It's a shame. But I do love travelling, I really do. You know, I love sort of going to somewhere like Australia or South Africa, seeing new places. And I came to Canada, I did the IGA opening concert in Toronto, it was about 6-7 years ago. That was fun, cold, but very, very great fun. That was in January. January in Toronto is cold.
Yes, yes. I lived in Toronto for a few years.
I don't want
to live back there in the winter.
No, exactly. Although I must say they've got it sorted, you know, with all that underground sort of shopping thing. We mm-hmm. walked some to places underground, not go out in the cold. But it was it was an experience. But I love travelling, it doesn't worry me at all.
One final question. Of mm-hmm. if you had to choose one song that would represent you, what would it be?
Oh, goodness. Oh, dear. I have no idea.
Or is it? Does it depend?
One song I really, really love, I think, would be from the Night Songs album. The Trouble with Hello is Goodbye. It's a Johnny Mandel song.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful one.
It's such a beautiful song. I think that's probably one that I would love. And it's a glorious string arrangement. As far as the jazz is concerned, goodness me, I don't know. I mean, the more strictly jazz. I'm Walking is a good one. That's a nice one. Love for Sale off the Fat Chops album is a good one. I don't know. You choose.
or do you have? It seems like maybe you have different songs from different areas.
I suppose so. I mean, mostly the albums I've built out are jazz albums. The Night Songs is because it's orchestral. It's slightly less jazzy. It's I suppose.
That was the one you recorded in the Netherlands, right?
In the Netherlands.
Was
yeah.
that with
yeah.
the, was that with the Metropole Orchestra?
It was with the Metropole. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, they seem to be recording with almost everybody. They're, I think, one of the most demanded...
Well, yeah, they had a really golden era for about, I don't know, about 15, 20 years, where, you know, visiting Americans came over, mm-hmm. and a lot of Brits came over, and Swedes, and, you know, anybody who had a sort of name singer or instrumentalist, if you were in Holland, you usually managed to get to record with them. I was lucky. I went over there about 5 or 6 years and did... various concerts and recordings with them, so it was wonderful.
But when you recorded with them, did you sing live or did you sing to a backing track?
Oh no, live in the huge studio, like mm-hmm. like a film studio, and as I say, yeah, 72-piece orchestra, and they had the music, they had the arrangements, which were all specifically done for me, which was lovely. And they rehearsed them before I got there, and then I flew in. And then we'd start about 9:30 in the morning and just sing it through. And if I was happy and they were happy and everybody was happy and the sound was happy, then we put the red light on and make a recording. And then we'd go up and have a listen to it, and if we all liked it, that was it. On to the next one. You know, it was brilliant. It was a wonderful way to work.
Many, many years ago, there was a singer whose name I can't remember... off the top of my head, and when I interviewed him, I pointed out something, and he said to me, "You're correct, because everybody figured it out, found there was something wrong." He had recorded with the Metropole, but the mm-hmm. music was recorded in the Netherlands, and then the tapes were sent over to New York, and he added his voice later. And he said it was one of the recordings that he was the least happy with, because he said as much as he tried to really get into it, it sounds like this complete distance between orchestra and singer. And I have a recording of that Rosemary Clooney made with Duke Ellington.
Uh-huh.
Duke Ellington's orchestra was recorded in Los Angeles. Rosemary Clooney recorded her vocals in New York City. This is the 1950s. Yeah. And it sounds like they're in not different cities, but different planets.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that sort of, I guess with today's sort of digital Skype and stuff, it's a lot easier to do that now and from different places. But no, I always loved working with the bands, the BBC bands as well, when I was recording with them. You know, it was always done in the studio all at once, all together, and no overdubbing, no sort of, we'll put the voice on later if it doesn't quite work, you know, none of that. It was just absolutely down live. And that's the way to work. It's got that immediacy about it. It's so fantastic.
But the recordings that you did, let's say, for the BBC or even Thames Television, do you have those recordings, or were they just the tapes just reused for something else?
Oh, gosh. I've got quite a lot of the BBC stuff, but that was quite some time ago when the BBC had money and was spending it on music. They said, no, not at all. No, I've got them on cassette, so that's how long ago it was.
Because that would be an interesting album. Lee Gibson on television.
Oh, I'll put it to spotlight, see if they want to do that.
Lee, thank you very much for joining us today on Jazz for the Asking. It's been a great pleasure. And, you know, it's funny because the first question that I led with, I remember thinking a long time ago, if I ever interviewed Lee Gibson, I have to explain to her how I first heard her sing, wearing that little top.
Well, I'm glad I pleased you, Papa. There you go.
Lee, thank you very much.
Keith, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
It's very clear. All of this here to stay. Not for real. Forever and a day. The radio and the telephone movies. When no opposite fancies, and in time may go. But oh my dear, our love is here to stay. Not for a year, forever and a day. Even time the rockets may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay. But our love is here, our love is here, our love is here to stay. Yeah!
Lee Gibson, our special guest on this edition of Jazz for the Asking. Find out what Lee is up to. You can visit her website, leegibson.co.uk. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of the program. Our email address is jazz@pcjmedia.com. We're going to end with another song from Lee Gibson from the CD, Here's to Love. That's all. Until next time, I'm Keith Powell saying so long and take care.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and a promise to be there each time you call. And the only heart I own for you when you're alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in the springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. A love burning bright, dew on the wintry night. That's all, that's all. There are those I have just who have told you, give you the world for a toy. All I have is these arms to enfold you, and a love that will never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, baby, please to know the my demands are small. See, it's me you adore, for now and evermore. That's all.
That's all.